drank so much liquor. I started off with beer, and then a blended whiskey, and then went to 100 proof Smirnoff. Fight just got started, and I was in it.
Did they arrest you? Did they arrest you?
Yeah. I broke your down jaw, popped his eye out on his head.
The cop?
Broke his rib, his shoulder, cracked his head. And the other guy that was in it, I threw him through a plate glass door. We were all friends, just three of us. Don't know yet what the hell happened. Somebody called the cops and woke up the next morning, my head felt like a sack of doorknobs. Oh, yeah. Don't remember this day what the hell it was about. It was a Hyundai. You should have seen my apartment. God damn it, looked like World War II did it. Blood all over the fucking walls, furniture turned upside down.
Jim and my father had a lot more in common. Both men worked in factories. Dad at Cleveland Twist Drill, Jim at General Motors. They hated their jobs. Dad tried to go to business college and dropped out. Jim tried college and he failed out. He said he couldn't focus on anything.
Do you think that came from the war, the violence, the drinking? Was that part of the war?
I don't know. Somebody was telling me here a while back, the PS,
PTSD.
PTS or whatever. So they don't have to happen right after the war. So they can go for years.
You know, you didn't talk about it back in those days, PTSD.
I know before I went in service, I was a damn honor student at a military school.
Really?
And when I enrolled in North Carolina State, I really couldn't concentrate. But before then, hell, I made A's and B's in military school.
Wow.
And something happened to my head, I guess. I don't know.
As we sat in his smoky living room, I noticed the couch, the carpet, and end tables all had cigarette burns. I soon learned why.
Every guy I talked to, you're the second guy I met from the unit. If you could sign on this page, anywhere you want, that'd be fantastic. You okay? Mr. Offridge? Are you okay? Can you hear me?
As he was talking to me, Jim just passed out. This was a long-standing problem. He didn't wake up for about 2 minutes.
Do you want to sit back? Mr. Lawford, you okay? Did something happen?
No, something. I hadn't really walked in a while.
He's kind of like almost went to sleep. I thought maybe you were having some kind of problem. Do you want to sit back for a little bit, sir?
And when it comes, it overwhelms me. But then when it leaves...
Oh, wow. So I'm glad you're okay.
When it leaves, I'm all right. I mean...
Is that part of your...
And when I hear it, I mean, when it starts, I can hear everything you say. I can hear everything that's going on around me. But my motor part, I can't move. I mean, I'm just... If I'm sitting here, I can't get up. If I'm standing up,
wow,
I can't move to sit down because I lose my balance and I crack my head a number of times.
I can't tell you how many times that has happened. He would tell me, I could hear everything you said. I'm aware of every movement you're making, but it's like I'm just frozen. And, you know, he was breathing, but yet he could not move a muscle. I was always afraid he would fall, and it's very scary.
Jim's daughter, Melody Simmons, explained that her dad's spells seemed to be triggered by emotion, especially when he talked about the war.
He would be like in CVS Pharmacy, and he always wore that Marine hat. Well, if anybody talked to him or saluted him or told him they appreciated his service, he would go into one of those spells. He felt like he didn't deserve to be... appreciated or, thanked. And if he felt any emotion, I noticed, like, say, he'd give me a gift or he'd give me, $50 or whatever, he would start to go into one of those spells. And so finally, I told him, I said, just don't give me any more money if you're going to have a spell. Don't give me any more gifts if you're going to have a spell. I'd rather you just keep it.
Not long after I visited Jim, Melody moved in with her dad to care for him. She said in the last months of his life, his remorse grew extremely intense.
One night, I could tell he was upset, you know, almost kind of tearful. And I think he was blaming himself for, just for being in the war and, you know, killing people. And, you know, he was blaming himself for that. And I told him, I said, well, you know, you did what you had to do. And he said, no, I didn't. And he was talking about those gold teeth. And he said, you know, I didn't have to do that. And of course, then he kind of broke down. But it's not like I ever see him break down. But he was just, I could tell he had so much remorse. And even there at the end, I think he was afraid. I think he was afraid he wasn't good enough to go to heaven.
Like me, Melody had no idea about blast concussion or traumatic brain injury as she dealt with her father's issues. Jim died in 2011.
I didn't even know about that blast that he was in. I mean, that would have been something that when I was going to all these doctors that I could have told them about, because, my gosh, he was bleeding out of his eyes and his ears and couldn't hear for a week. I mean, you don't think that that's going to affect somebody? If I had known that at the time I was talking to these doctors, because I was taking him for scans, one time they thought, well, maybe he's having many strokes. Well, it wasn't that. Then they said, well, maybe he's having these little seizures. And it wasn't that. So nobody could pinpoint it.
Now we're going to pick up some Naval Robinson oranges. These are big ones. They weigh about a pound and a half. There's one right there. Isn't that a beauty? There you are. Now we'll pick another one. There's Papa's. There we are. And one for Mama. And I will get one for Lindsay.
My father, as he got older, he mellowed a lot. And I recall in our conversation some years ago that some people either mellow, you say, or some get more combative. Why is that? Why does that happen?
More severe traumatic brain injuries, which may be what your father had, can trigger long-term neurodegeneration, something that akin to kind of like an Alzheimer's disease. Except this is like a time zero of the exposure to the injury, and that moment might change your brain forever. Some individuals with traumatic brain injury have a higher risk to develop Alzheimer's disease. Age-related cognitive decline can occur at an earlier age in these individuals as well. So, I mean, it could be that you either have this progressive change or the cognitive decline with aging just manifests earlier because you had the injury that kind of lowered your threshold to reverse that. Educating the families, the caregivers, is really important because they it really changes the whole perspective. You also give them something to look forward to. Say, well, if we instate this type of rehab treatment, we expect these types of outcomes. And so just educating patients and their caregivers it really can make a huge difference in overall outcome.
I wish I'd have met you 45, 50 years ago. In my case, just even knowing when I was younger that my father had these issues and he wasn't just crazy, maybe we would have treated him differently as a family. It seems pretty elementary in hindsight, but as kids, my brother and I never thought our father's rage was caused by blast concussion. The more I learned, the more I realized that my father's brain was damaged. It was a real breakthrough in understanding him and maybe myself. I wonder if we'd have known, if somebody would have come in and said, from the military, let's say the military was taking care of these guys. Look, your father has traumatic brain injury and he's going to have these raging fits. You know,
get the kids counseling.
Yeah. Something. Nothing was done for him or us.
No, you did your service. You came home. I mean, back then they didn't call them heroes. You went back to your life. But, you know, you left when you're 18. You're 24 now. You come back or whatever. You don't have a life. Your only life you know is fighting the Japs or the Germans.
I wondered how much rage and trauma was inherited by us children of World War II dads. Could it be genetic? An Emory University study exposed male mice to both a mild shock and a cherry blossom odor. The mice were then bred. As adults, those offspring became anxious and fearful when they were exposed to the scent of cherry blossom. This is called epigenetics. I believe I did inherit my father's trauma, and until recently, I had no idea my brother was still dealing with the turmoil of our childhood.
I saw a psychiatrist 6-7 years ago. I had 6 weeks, 6 sessions. I spilled my guts. And near into it, he says, "Do you think you have PTSD?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "I agree, you do. You know, from childhood."
Do you remember any good things?
Yeah, I mean, like the fishing trips. I do remember Canada. We went to Canada and we camped. I mean, it was a good time. I don't even think he yelled once that trip. I mean, who knows, maybe something insignificant. The only thing that comes to mind, remember when he had his bridge worked on, he had no front teeth, and I think this turned the tide for me, but he was yelling at me, he was going, it was all I could do to stop not laugh, because he had no front teeth.
Did he see you were trying to laugh or no?
It may have made him madder.
Oh, shit.
But he had no front teeth.
A lot of us kids wished we knew then what we know now. Marie read from a moving message she sent me back in 2013. She responded to an article I wrote about my dad and Mulligan.
"After reading your account, I began to wonder which of us was better off. You're experiencing the constant, very real threat of rage from your dad, or me experiencing no hope of emotional expression from mine. I quickly came to the conclusion that neither of us was better off. We just have very different experiences initiated by very similar circumstances. It's sad that we think we have progressed so much as a world society. However, we still make the choice of violence to reach solution of problems, leaving both visible and invisible scars that reach across generations. I can't help but imagine, what if?"
What if they'd gotten the help they needed? What if the explosion never happened? What if we understood all of this back then? What if? In some ways, Joe Rosblock was my answer to that question. I finally got to have the conversations with him that I was never able to have with my father.
"Everything that happened to me in my life, each daughter has a shoebox in the closet, and each shoebox is filled with 90-minute cassette tapes. And every time I took a trip, I had a voice-activated tape recorder, and I would talk to my daughter about everything in our family, everything that happened to me in the Marine Corps, everything, how I met my wife. I would have that on its seat beside me, but beside me was a stuffed doll, about three feet high. In other words, if you drove by me in a car, you saw me talking, you would think I was talking to another person.
But there was nobody else in the car except you.
Me and that doll."
Oh, man. I wish I had that for my dad. Oh, what a gift for your kids.
"Well, I always said to my kids, I would give anything in the world, money-wise, if I had a recording of my wife's voice, even if she was reading the contents on a mayonnaise jar."
Oh, gee.
I was beginning to accept that I might never get those answers. My dad didn't leave tapes, and I might never find Mulligan, but I was bringing something else home.
"I love you, and I'm sorry I can't be more help. I want to thank you because you really, it's the first time I've ever had a chance to talk to anybody about what went on in my life.
I want to thank you back because all these conversations we've had over the last year by phone, really have helped me understand what my father went through more than all the guys. I talked to 29 guys from L Company on the phone. I met with 15 of them in the last 10 years, most of them in the last couple of years. But out of everybody, you've helped me understand things more than anybody. So I want to thank you back.
You have to talk about your experience. You can't hide it. See, what's making me feel good is because maybe what I'm saying to you is going to help somebody else.
Joe hoped our conversations would impact younger veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Despite his numerous severe health issues, including cancer and stents in his legs, he still managed to volunteer at local nursing homes. He plays his keyboard mostly for people with dementia, under the stage name Sylvester Metamucil.
You sound really chipper and really good.
Well, I think it's because I do a lot of volunteer work in the nursing homes.
Are you still doing the Sylvester Metamucil thing?
I see how the other people are suffering. I'm not suffering. You know.
That's a good attitude to have, Joe.
I'm a freaking hero, as far as I'm concerned.
You are, damn it.
If it wasn't for me, you'd be speaking Japanese.
There we go. And whatever that guy wrote in that roster, the heck with him, you know?
When somebody dies that you know real well, you've lost a part of yourself. A part of yourself is buried with them. Oh, my wife said, how can you think that way? Well, that's just the way I am. It's easy to die. That's not the tragedy of war. The tragedy of war are the families left behind. When you die, it's quick and it's over. But for families, wives and mothers, it goes on year after year after year, the tragedy. And that is the tragedy of war. That's why I write letters to all the families of all the men that were killed.
Chapter 4, PFC Mulligan.
Captain Frank Hagler, the souvenir collector, also kept in touch with the families of the men killed under his command. Among his treasures, he had a file cabinet in his basement museum. It was filled with years of correspondence with those families. He always sent Christmas cards.
I knew how they would feel right after the war. I thought, gee, I've got to let them know that somebody is still thinking of their sons or their husbands. I'm kind of a sentimental buzzard. So, I save all this. I have all this correspondence, letters, everything.
After the war, Frank made a vastly different career change. Here's his daughter, Lynn Hagler Baker.
Originally, he thought he would be career military, but eventually he realized that his personality in the military probably would not jive very well in the long run. He told me he chose obstetrics because people mostly were there having happy events in their life. So he said he consciously chose that because it would be mostly happy patients. Did he share with you the Borelli story?
Borelli, refresh me. Which one's that? Lynn recalled one of her dad's favorite stories. She read an entry from his journal about a chance meeting he had with a patient.
Let's see. She informed me her family was all living and well with the exception of her oldest son who had been killed in the war. I expressed sympathy and asked conversationally how he had died and was informed he had been a Marine corporal and had died near the end of the war on some island. Okinawa? She said. This startled me and I asked if her former residence had been in Jersey City, New Jersey. Yes, she said. I asked Mrs. Borelli if her son wasn't Corporal
Sam Borelli, L Company, 22nd Marines, and he was killed on the 7th of May, 1945. And she said, how do you know that? And I said, Mrs. Borelli, have you gotten a Christmas card every year from your son's former captain? And she said, well, we get a Christmas card from some Marine officer. I said, that's me. Sam was one of my boys. And I had pictures of her son, Sam, that she had never seen, and pictures of the cemetery on Okinawa. And then I was able to answer a few little questions she had. But that was one of the most amazing coincidences that I've ever had. And I've had a lot of them.
After Frank died in 2011, Lynn said his mini museum was dismantled and the items were either sold or given away. It took years for her to truly understand the importance of his collection.
I mean, he didn't just collect military things. He was a Boy Scout. He had a whole collection of every badge that the Boy Scouts ever gave out. It was an incredible thing to look at. It was beautiful, actually. He collected coins from different countries, stamps. He collected all kinds of things. While my dad didn't talk about his personal experiences in the war, his life was filled with it. And that was pretty obvious. He read World War II history books constantly. And then he had, of course, his vehicles. So he was reliving World War II a lot.
Well, you know, the thing that was most profound out of the many things your dad did for me was he was such a super helpful guy. But he kept all those letters to the families, which blew me away.
Yes. Well, he didn't want to just collect to have it. He liked to understand what these things were, what they meant. He was always interested in stories, and collections make a story.
March 16th, 1949. Dear Frank, just a few lines to ask if you could get me any information concerning PFC Herman Mulligan. I received a telegram stating that he had been killed on Okinawa, May 30th, 1945. Then when I wrote for his body, they knew nothing concerning his burial. I take it you knew him by the Christmas card that you sent me. I suppose he told you about me. I am his grandfather and I am blind and sure would appreciate any information you could give me. Thank you, Robert G. Owens. Please let me know as soon as possible so I will know what to do.
I couldn't believe it. Frank had letters from Mulligan's grandfather. Mulligan's guardian, Robert G. Owens, was blind. His letters were full of misspellings and they were handwritten in old-fashioned fountain pen. Frank filed them under M for Mulligan. They were like gold to me. Mr. Owens really wanted to bring his boy home. He died at the age of 84 in 1963. For years, I struggled to find Mulligan's surviving relatives. I visited their hometown in Greenville, South Carolina, where he lived in a tiny clapboard house with Mr. Owens. I knocked on a lot of doors, but I couldn't find any neighbors who knew them. They were a family of cotton mill workers. Before he joined the Marines, Mulligan worked at Monahan Mills, which paid 40 cents an hour on average. According to his mother's death certificate, she died at 35 from a kidney infection. Mulligan was an only child. I suspected that his father was not in the picture. His aunt on his mom's side married a guy whose last name was Patterson. I thought my best bet was trying to find one of Mulligan's three cousins, Willis, Ernest, and James. But there were thousands of Pattersons in the White Pages, and those who responded to my letters were not relatives. So in 2011, I reached out for help and called the military agency responsible for recovering the missing war dead. It was called the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, JPAC for short, which was based in Hawaii.
Drew, I can't tell you how many phone calls I've made. Hundreds. Mm-hmm. I sent probably 250 letters out to every Patterson and Mulligan in key towns in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I'm having no luck. There's two cousins. One had kids, and their name is Patterson. And that's like Smith in the South. It's just, there's a million of them. But I've had no luck. But, you know, if I could find them, you know, it'd be nice to connect them and get a name on his grave. But we'll see where that goes.
Uh-huh. Now, do you have any information as far as, like, the circumstances under which Mulligan went missing or died?
It was May 30th, 1945. He threw a grenade into a tomb east of Naha. It was full of Japanese munitions. Mm-hmm. It went up like a volcano, the guys told me.
Now, did you get an idea about what, not to get too graphic, of like what the state of his body was? Was he in pieces? Was he pretty whole?
I spoke with Dr. Drew Spielhofer, a JPAC historian. I told him about the explosion and how Joe Rossblatt carried away the body. I also explained all the files I had, including copies of the letters from Mr. Owens.
if I could find the relatives, then there would be DNA. And what I'd like to tell them that what happened was, like, the letters from the grandfather were plaintive. They were so sad to the captain. You know, what happened to my boy? So I know it tore the family apart. It's just like it tore my dad apart. Mm-hmm. So if I can connect them, and my attitude is this: I'm doing a book. It's going to come out in 2013. And they may come forward later. This is a lifelong project. If somebody reads the book in 2015, I'm going to try to connect things. This just seems something I need to do.
Okay. Well, if you'd like us to take a look at it, those of us in the historian section, we'd be willing to. But we just, to be honest, it's not a campaign we deal a lot with, just because there's so few missing and there's so few unknowns from that battle. So.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Spielhofer was being honest. The agency didn't prioritize guys like Mulligan, who were missing from the Battle of Okinawa. When the case got handed off to other researchers, my further contact with JPEG seemed to fall on deaf ears. I'd hit a dead end. The words of Frank Palmisani and Joe Rossblock echoed in my head. Part of me wondered if Mulligan wasn't still buried in the rubble on Okinawa. So I went there myself to retrace the steps of Love Company and find the site of the explosion. The route they took under machine gun fire was now a dense urban neighborhood. Yet it was easy to find using Frank's topographic map and a vintage combat photo. What remained of the exploded tomb was still there behind an office complex. It was a mini jungle of trees and philodendrons, which reminded me of my mother's houseplants. During the day, there were birds that screeched, and at night, there were bugs that screamed. This is going to sound crazy. I took a metal spoon with me, thinking I might find Mulligan's dog tags, or maybe even bones. I chipped at the ground with the spoon, but it was hard as concrete. For 2 weeks, I went back to the site almost every evening. I got on my hands and knees and crawled through Japanese defense caves, but all I found were pieces of shoes and fragments from American grenades. The U.S. Navy blasted more than 600,000 shells on the island and fired 1.8 million rounds of artillery. Many of Okinawa's hills were hit by so many explosions that they lost height and changed shape. This is how most of the 150,000 civilians died, killed by our bombs. In later wars, we call this collateral damage.
How did you live in the caves? Were you always in the cave? Were they deep?
その豪の中にいた行った時のその生活というか、その様子とはどういう感じだったんですか？
豪の中で、何話ですか？
豪の中での数日間こう暮らしたその豪過ごしたその豪の中ですけど、様子はどんな感じでしたか？
いや、だから18日までね、18日にね、こうやって辰夫と別れてからね、今頃から思い出したの、18日別れてからうちの豪戦車が来たんですよ、目の前に。で、僕は余計なことしなきゃいけないのに、迫撃を、小さな迫撃を、あれで。
Yoshikuni Yamada, a native Okinawan, was one of the Taketsu Kinotai, which translates to Blood and Iron Corps, but more commonly has come to stand for the Boy Soldiers. They were forced by the Japanese to fight the Americans. Mr. Yamada was just 15 in 1945. He fled directly in front of Love Company in the last month of the battle. He was blinded in one eye and hid in a cave, where he was found by a U.S. soldier who took him prisoner. My colleague Kojiro Yamada translated for Mr. Yamada. No relation.
We are heavily attacked, and you hear a soldier committing suicide using the hand grenade. And I remember that one soldier was forcing some guy who was dying to say Tenno Heika Banzai before he died, putting a gun into his mouth. What's the weapon that this guy, the nasty?
It's the phosphorus grenade.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, came to his cave, and I used my my pee to cover my face and just have to just stay there quietly.
Mr. Yamada had to wash his face with his own urine to stop the burning from the phosphorus. He told me Okinawa is full of ghosts. When he played golf, he said he'd see Japanese soldiers running in and out of caves next to the greens. It sounded fantastical, but I believed him.
This one is also it's a cave here. If you see it, this was an opening before this here.
How did it get closed?
This place was covered with human bones after the war. Yeah. So somebody had to come here and seal it and just so they're still here.
Filled it in.
In this area, there's tens of thousands of dead bodies.
I followed them down a narrow trail through the jungle brush. Mr. Yamada retraced the steps he took as a boy when he ran from the American soldiers. Creepily, U.S. military aircraft from one of our Okinawa bases were flying overhead as if the war hadn't ended. And it hadn't for Mr. Yamada, who was still haunted by those days. He was intense and emotional as he hurried ahead of me on the trail. He wanted to show me something, but I wasn't sure what. He told me this is where he carried his mortally wounded friend, Tatsuo.
That day, I was carrying Tatsuo, and I came over here and tried to. There's some little small village that direction, so I tried to take him over there. And the Americans were chasing them. And a lot of shelling here, and it was like hell. And I was carrying him, and it was, to be honest with you, he was heavy, and I couldn't carry him. So I thought I was going to die, and I placed him over here in front of this this rock and gave him only one hand grenade left. Very soon I'm going to die anyway, so I come later. And that was the last time I saw him. So every time I think of that, I feel guilty.
Does he think that Tetsuo's bones are in that cave? Somebody put him in there?
My question went unanswered. I learned from Kojiro that Mr. Yamada had been coming here twice a week for decades. This trail was made by his feet. Mr. Yamada pulled some items out of his satchel. An orange, a cup and a bottle of green tea. Some flowers. He set them on a rock and lit incense. Then he started praying to his friend Tatsuo, who he had to leave for dead at the base of this rock. I decided on my last day in the island to hold my own ceremony. Like Mr. Yamada, I brought an orange and tea and incense and went to the tomb, where I set down the picture of my dad and Mulligan. I'm not religious, so I simply said this. Herman Walter Mulligan, you died here May 30th, 1945. My father Steve was very troubled by what happened. He didn't forget you. I want you to know that you were not forgotten. In 2013, my book Bringing Mulligan Home was published. It was about finding the man in the picture, but I really hadn't brought him home. I did a few months of promotion and media appearances, the last of which was an NPR interview. Then that night, I got an email from a listener.
Hello. I enjoyed your interview today on an NPR program I happened to catch. As you mentioned in your recounting of your father's inexplicable rage and the many children of World War II vets who experienced the same, I suppose that I can be added to that group as well. When you talked about this, it stopped me in my tracks and took me back to my own childhood. More importantly, for the past 40 years, I've been honing my skills as a family historian and hometown genealogist. I'm pretty good at finding people, and have helped many friends and acquaintances to discover their roots and their ancestors. I'd be happy to take a look through the many resources that I use to see if I can come up with any further information about the Herman Mulligan of whom you have written. I love this stuff, and I love a mystery. It would be great to make a go at it. Sincerely, Bridget Carroll, Stanton, Virginia.
I accepted Bridget Carroll's generous offer in a brief reply, but I didn't think there was any chance that she'd actually find them.
I uncovered the fact that Herman Mulligan's father lived for a long time and had remarried a neighbor's wife after the neighbor died, and I couldn't find any more Mulligan kids.
The work of a genealogist is painstaking. For 6 months, Bridget spent uncountable hours looking through birth and death certificates, marriage records, census reports. She pored through archive newspaper stories and old city directories. She even called churches and caretakers of old cemeteries. Bridget turned her attention to Mulligan's cousins.
I eliminated a lot and then found a lot of different Pattersons. And then James looked to me to be the best bet because he was a first cousin to Herman.
Bridget hit the jackpot in Charlotte, North Carolina, where she found James Patterson and his wife Jean in 2014. She knew she had the right James because of his date of birth. Days later, we met over Skype. It was unreal that I was finally talking to one of Mulligan's relatives.
Look, now I'm looking at the ceiling. I almost don't see anybody. If you could...
Hold on.
I can see you when you're talking. Oh, there you are. Hi.
James was too young to have known Herman Mulligan. He was born in 1942. But he was close to Mr. Owens, their grandfather.
He was sharp as a tack up until about 3 months before he died. He has always amazed me. I spent a lot of time with Granddad. And I was the only one of the grandchildren that did spend time with him. And I would get him, even when I played Little League ball, I would take him to the ball field with me, and he would sit in the bleachers while I practiced. And sit and smoke his pipe. I can see him just as good now as I can see you.
James had heard stories about Mulligan from his family. For some reason, they called him Dick. No one knows why.
What about Herman Mulligan's father? Did he vanish? Did anybody ever see him again or talk to him again?
That's, like I say, the only thing that I know about his dad was what Mom told me about him. His dad was an abusive person to his mom, Lois, and I think that might have been one of the reasons that Herman joined the Marine Corps. Now, of course, he went to live with Granddaddy when his mom died. Mama always called Herman Dick. Now, I don't know where that came from. And we have his Purple Heart and his dog tag here.
Do you have one dog tag or two?
One.
Do you know how Mr. Owens got it?
No, I do not.
Can you see it here, Dale?
I can see the Purple Heart. Can you lift it a little bit? Oh my gosh, there it is. Yeah, wow.
I stared at the dog tag. It raised a lot of questions. If his body was missing, how did they have it? The tiny metal plate, though worn down, still read, Mulligan, Herman W. Jr., A96478. There was a P for Protestant. It showed that he had a tetanus shot in December 1942 and that his blood type was O. The last line says USMCR for US Marine Corps.
I really would like to put a name on Mr. Mulligan's grave. The Hickam Air Force Base, they do the searching for the missing in action and the POWs who are gone. And I've been talking to them, and they said if we get DNA, we will exhume the several bodies we think he might be, and then we can put a name on Mr. Mulligan's grave. I don't know how you feel about that. Would you like to see that happen?
Sure. That would be great. I think it would mean a lot to my mom and my granddad.
And mom would say?
And my nephew. He was in the Marine Corps. He lost a foot in Vietnam.
When I shipped out and got to Parris Island, you know, of course, they always bring everybody in the middle of the night so you don't see where you're actually coming into. And the guy jumped on the bus with this nice tone of voice and said he was going to get us ready for Vietnam. And I turned to the guy next to me and I said, "What is Vietnam?" I soon found out I was just totally out of touch, you know. And I said, I might have made a mistake here.
Robert Patterson joined the Marines because of his father, Willis, James's brother, who'd been a Marine in the Korean War. And Willis joined because of his cousin, Mulligan. Robert lost his left leg in 1968 during a mission to rescue some wounded soldiers when a rocket exploded near him.
And then the corpsman says, "I'm running out of bandages. Find a place that's bleeding the worst. I've got one left. Stick it in it." So that's what I did. I ran my hand down behind my leg. And my hand went up in my leg, and I said, "I guess that's the worst," and stuck it up in there. And
you could have easily died.
Yeah, I guess.
In one of his emails to me, Robert signed it "The Fat One-Legged Marine." When we finally met in person, I asked why he called himself that.
You know, life's too short to be, I don't know, down and out about stuff. I said, "I come home alive. How can I possibly ever feel bad for myself? I was blessed."
He remembered stories from his dad, Willis, about Mulligan.
I think there was 6 years difference in Herman's age and my dad's. And they were like brothers, you know. Every time Herman would come in on leave or something like that, they would chum together, you know, and get into trouble together. And they used to pull tricks on my great-grandfather. Because my great-grandfather was blind, you know, just jokester-type stuff. And so they were really close. And then when he got killed in 1945, I think that was the determining factor that my dad joined the Marine Corps also. My dad would bring him up every once in a while, and especially when I was headed to Vietnam and he knew I was going to go through Okinawa. He had asked me if I could find Dick's grave. That's what he always called him. But, you know, we were there only a short period of time to get the shots and drop off stuff and get on the plane and head to Vietnam. I wouldn't have known where to look anyway. I mean, I had no clue. I just figured he was probably in the 6th Marine Division graveyard. And
well, you didn't, nobody knew where he was. No. You didn't know that at the time. I mean, you know, he's unknown, but
all we knew is he got killed in Okinawa. And that was about it, you know. Tell you the truth, I didn't really know his real name was Herman Walter Mulligan. All I'd ever heard him call was Dick.
Though he never came home, Mulligan's legacy continued in the family. When Willis died, they discovered a picture of his cousin in his wallet. The picture's all worn and blurry from it being in his wallet for years. Familiar cone-shaped tents and palm trees are in the background. It's clearly Guadalcanal, like my dad's photo.
Did you know he carried that picture in the wallet?
Quite frankly, I didn't. I didn't know he even had that picture.
It was in his wallet when he died, right?
Yeah.
Wow. There's my dad with Dick on his wall, and then your dad with a picture in his wallet all those years.
Yeah, and we knew nothing, did we?
Nothing.
Till you started digging.
Until I got nosy and dug around. Yeah.
Mulligan was symbolic in my life, but after meeting the Pattersons, he'd become real, a man who actually walked this earth. I was now bonded with Mulligan's relatives. Gene Patterson dubbed us the Bringing Mulligan Home family. The group included Jean, James, and Robert, as well as Bridget the genealogist, and me. As we got to know each other, we agreed on one thing. We had to finally bring Mulligan home. James sent a blood sample to the military so they could have his DNA. With that DNA, if the remains could be located, we could identify Mulligan.
Mr. Patterson, it'll be so amazing if it works and they can identify his remains. I get emotional just thinking about how that would be for my father, for your grandfather and your mom, what that would mean. I'm really excited about doing this, but it's very emotional for me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Well, it's become kind of emotional for us too, I believe, just knowing that there was somebody there that we didn't know about who was never brought home. So for me, if it was one of my family, I don't care how far back it was, if there was a way for me to help bring that person home, then I would want to know that.
But there was one huge problem, JPEC. The military agency that I'd reached out to was blowing off its mission. It seemed as if my letters and emails over the years were simply filed away and forgotten.
These are letters from my great-grandfather, Robert G. Owens, dated 9/30/1945. Dear sir, I am writing you about my ward, PFC Herman Walter Mulligan, Jr. I have got a letter saying they have no record where he was buried, and I would like very much for you to let me know just how he was killed and where he was hit at and if he was buried or not. Yours truly, Robert G. Owens, Greenville, South Carolina.
Chapter 5. Finding Mulligan.
Home, family, dignity. These are just a few of the many reasons that we repatriate our war dead. War, of course, is as old as humanity. Yet bringing home the fallen is a uniquely American ritual that can be traced back to World War I. After centuries of war, most European countries didn't do this. And Japan is just starting to collect their dead from World War II. Until World War I, our young nation had not experienced many conflicts overseas. More than 100,000 Americans were killed, and their bodies were interred in military cemeteries, most of them all over France. The loss was palpable on the home front. Parents wanted their boys buried on American soil. But politicians and General John Pershing wanted to leave the fallen abroad, and France considered the transportation of coffins gruesome, forbidding the removal of the American dead. The U.S. government offered instead to send grieving mothers to Europe to visit their sons' graves, but they gave in to pressure after receiving 40,000 requests from parents to bring their sons' bodies home. Those parents, known as Gold Star families, organized to pressure lawmakers. They marched on the Capitol, they testified before Congress, and they sent letters to newspapers. Here's one from a mother who wrote to the New York Tribune in 1921.
3 years ago, our government promised to return to mourning parents the bodies of those dear ones who made the supreme sacrifice for a noble cause. Since that time, I and many more have been anxiously awaiting the hour when the bodies of our sons shall be brought back. The thought of having at least the material remains of the dear departed buried in their own country so that the parents could have easy access to the graves has been a source of solace and comfort to the bereaved. It was my son's wish before he left this country that in case of death, he should have a military funeral. If I left any stone unturned to bring about this result, I feel I should fall short of a mother's duty. In chapter 49 of Genesis, verse 29, we find that Jacob, the prince of Israel, requested his son Joseph to bury him in the land of his fathers. Mrs. S. Rubel, sorrowful mother of First Lieutenant Solomon Rubel.
One man even traveled from Wisconsin to France to dig up his only son's body. He was quoted in the Los Angeles Times in 1919. Of course, I know the government did the best it could with what it had, but that don't keep my boy dry. Basswood won't stand the pressure of 6 feet of earth or moisture. It is curling up already. I bought the best casket I could find in Paris, and I took it out myself, while guards stood around to make sure that we didn't snatch the body. If my boy gave his life for his country, I don't see why his mother can't have the body. Almost a century later, families were still fighting the government over this. JPAC, the agency created to find our U.S. war dead and rebury them on American soil, was spending more than $100 million every year. In 2013, the Associated Press published a leaked report by a general who called the agency a total failure. Only about 72 identifications were made every year, at a cost that averaged almost $1.5 million per body brought home. Only JPAC could recover Mulligan's body, but the agency wasn't doing its job. After James Patterson sent them his DNA, he and Jean met with officials twice. The DNA was useless, however, without Mulligan's remains. Then in 2014, U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel ordered massive changes.
In February, I directed the acting Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Mike Lumpkin, to provide me with recommendations on how to reorganize the Joint Prisoner of War Missing in Action Accounting Command, or otherwise known as JPAC, so that DOD could more effectively account for our missing personnel and ensure their families receive timely and accurate information. These steps will help improve the accounting mission, increase the number of identifications of our missing, provide greater transparency for their families, and expand our case file system to include all missing personnel. We will continue to do everything we can to account for and bring as many of our missing and fallen service personnel as possible home here to the United States. There's not a more poignant, emotional, important issue in our society today, and you all know this, than you take care of the people who gave their lives to this country, and you take care of their families. And that has been a critical component of who we are as Americans from the beginning of this republic.
JPAC ceased to exist. It was replaced by the new Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, DPAA for short. In theory, the DPAA would actually look for missing service members and would do more exhumations. After 14 years of searching, it just didn't seem like things would change. But we had relatives putting pressure on the new agency to find Mulligan's body. And there was media coverage. My book was out there in the public eye. Then serendipity intervened again. A secret weapon joined the Bringing Mulligan Home family.
I'm a nerd with a fucking gun. Like, think about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people in the military, like...
Rob Rumsby is a 27-year-old U.S. Army veteran, researcher, and self-taught remains recovery expert. He saw a Facebook post Gene made about Mulligan and offered to help. When I met with Rob, we usually hung out at Arlington National Cemetery.